Welcome to KSFC Talks, the budding business of marijuana. I'm your host, Steve Jackson. Washington State is on the cutting edge of what might be viewed as an experiment. It joins Colorado and the nation of Uruguay in legalizing marijuana for recreational use. Is it the start of a nationwide trend or just a temporary situation? Joining me on this panel this afternoon, we have Allison Holcomb, the Criminal Justice Director for the ACLU of Washington. She was the architect of Marijuana Legalization Initiative 502 and the campaign director for New Approach Washington. That was the committee that secured the passage of the initiative by a 56-44 margin. Also, Spokane County Sheriff Ozzy Knezovich, who was appointed as county sheriff in 2006. Later that year, he was elected and is now serving in his second term. The sheriff has 24 years in law enforcement experience and has worked in various capacities, including patrol deputy, property crimes detective, and SWAT team supervisor. Chris Marr, who served as state senator for the 6th District in Spokane from 2007 to 2010. After leaving office, Chris was appointed by Governor Chris Gregoire to the Washington State Liquor Control Board and is currently involved in establishing the world's first legalized cannabis marketplace. And executive director of the Washington State affiliate of the National Organization for Reform of Marijuana Laws, or NORML. That's Kevin Oliver, who has maintained a network of county chapters throughout the state. Most recently, Kevin has represented NORML to the World Affairs Council in Seattle and has a marijuana producer's license. Thanks so much to all you folks for coming in today. This will be an interesting discussion. We've got an hour ahead of us. I want to jump right into one of the topics. We have seen this pass successfully. Now the marijuana sales are in place. I want to know specifically a little bit about the amount of revenue that's coming into the state right now. We heard a report last week, and specific figures were given. I'll address this to Chris, but anybody can jump in. And Allison, you may want to address this too. First of all, how are we? Are we on track for the amount of state revenues that are coming in? And the follow-up question would be to Allison, is this kind of what you envisioned at this point in time?
Well, the income for this particular biennium, which doesn't have long to run, was somewhat speculative, but we are on track. I think we've taken in, we've had about $16 million year to date in terms of sales and about $4 million worth of excise tax receipts. Going forward, if you look at the next 2 years, we anticipate about $180 million over that two-year period, and that should double to close to $350 million in the 2017 through 2019 period. So if you remember, the Office of Financial Management said early on in the initiative process it would be between $0 and $2 billion over a five-year period. It looks like we're towards the higher end of that range, and that doesn't include, by the way, sales tax or B&O taxes.
And so, Allison, how does that fit in with what you'd envision when you helped craft this law?
Well, you know, when we were drafting Initiative 502, we were really looking at trying to generate revenue that would be roughly equivalent to what the Washington State Office for Financial Management estimated for Representative Mary Lou Dickerson's legalization bills introduced in 2010 and 2011. So we were trying to get somewhere close to about $300 million in annual revenue, understanding that it's all guesswork because nobody really knows where marijuana's price point will land in a fully legal market. And in addition to all of that, I will say that the sponsors of the initiative, including former U.S. Attorney John McKay and Public Health Director Kim Thorburn, all of us were really not so much concerned about making sure that we generated a specific amount of revenue, but that the revenue was coming via legal regulated businesses and generating tax revenue for the state and the people of Washington, rather than flowing to the criminal organizations that were reaping all of the benefits up to that point.
Mm-hmm. Chris, can we put this into context? Do we know what Colorado, off the top of your head, do you know what Colorado's input has been, or do you know that?
I don't have those numbers. Colorado will be significantly less. They have a little less aggressive tax structure. But keep in mind, that number is very scalable. When I say $350 million over a biennium, that assumes that we'll have about 25% of the marketplace. We can talk more about this in a while, but realistically, we're competing with both the illicit market and an unregulated medical marijuana marketplace. So that's based on having a small market share, and I guess our feeling is, as we move ahead, it's a scalable system, and we want to get it right, and we have the ability to expand that, in part through policy decisions that I think we're going to be talking a little about today.
Okay. And Sheriff, you had some input on that, too?
The estimates from Colorado are right at about $65 to $118 million.
Okay, so we're ahead of them apparently for these projections.
The projections that you just said would be ahead of them. Yes.
Okay. So here's some questions for you, Sheriff. Law enforcement authorities right now, would you say that you are saving money and or time by not having to go after, you know, marijuana smokers? And then the follow-up to that, which I want to pose to you right now so you can think about it, is what about devoting resources now to looking for the black market growers and sellers? Because I know when Chris and I had discussed this before, that was one of the federal mandates, that the federal government would look the other way if there was, you know, a crackdown and so forth on the black market. So does that put you in an unusual position now, or?
Well, let's talk about the first one as far as savings. There have been no savings, and there were never going to be any savings, because the myth was that we spent all this revenue trying to go after misdemeanor marijuana. Mm-hmm. And the Spokane County Jail, let's take it back, I think it was 2012, 2011, approximately 375 people were arrested and booked into the Spokane County Jail with misdemeanor marijuana-related charges. Out of that 375, only 55 of those were for purely misdemeanor marijuana. Once you took a look at that, only 6 out of that 55 spent more than 48 hours in jail.
Mm-hmm.
So that tells you just how few people were actually arrested for purely misdemeanor marijuana and booked into jail, and only 6 spent more than 48 hours. So it wasn't that.
Never a priority.
It was never that priority. It was never that big of a problem, especially when it comes to the overcrowding of jails. The black market aspect, yes, that's going to be a drain on our resources. And, you know, Chris mentioned it. It's a muddy when you start talking about the medical side of the marijuana issues here in the state of Washington. In order to look at the illicit side of the medical marijuana side, we literally have to investigate it in reverse and prove it that it's not legitimate rather than illegal. And when you take a look at the black market's thriving. Right now, I think I have that here. The cost for a gram through the retailer is roughly $16 to $26 a gram. Black market, you're looking at $11.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't seen any decrease in sales, if you will. If anything, the regular market right now is always so short a product that, you know, they're still going to the black market to fill the demand.
Now, have you, you know, being that Chris had told me that the federal government had sort of told Washington State to make sure that we were, you know, cracking down on the black market, you haven't had any, though, mandates to do that. You're just doing business as per normal, correct?
It is very much business as per normal. You know, we are so focused right now on property crimes that going after marijuana is kind of, if we run into it through investigations of property crimes or other drugs, then we'll deal with that. Mm-hmm. But right now, that is not a priority. It's truly not a priority. In the great expense that we're looking at, I'm looking at 34 less deputies than I had in 2008 because of the economy. I don't have time or the resources to devote to the black market for marijuana when I have property crimes that we have to deal with. Now, do the two go hand in hand? In some respect, but that's where the priority is right now.
Chris, when we talked about that mandate from the federal government, was there any way that they were going to be checking on that to see? I mean, what were their criteria to determine if, you know, there was a lot of black market activity?
Well, the concern is around diversion, participation of gangs and the flourishing of the illicit market. Let me say that we engage in a lot of discussion with law enforcement, from the DEA down to local police. To my mind, there really isn't any doubt that these large-scale commercial grows you hear about, I'm not seeing a change in terms of that approach. And typically, it has been an interagency approach. It has been led by the DEA and so on. I'm not hearing from local law enforcement. What I'm hearing, however, is from, like, the sheriff or any police chief, is answerable to elected officials.
Mm-hmm.
And they have some question about what are the priorities of local law enforcement. If there are a number of property crimes being reported, their question is, should marijuana necessarily be a priority? Because, the state apparently is tolerating its recreational use and we don't participate in the revenue stream. I think we have to honestly say that's part of the discussion. I think part of it, as we met with them, and there was, I think, some frustration there, in no small part because we had a medical marijuana system that everyone knew was unregulated, and we're asking law enforcement to address it. So
yeah.
I think when we go back to this issue about how you keep it in check, from our standpoint as regulators trying to run this system, we'd like to see that not the one plant or 1 ounce possession, but the larger scale garage grows that, to be honest with you, present some problem in terms of youth access and also interfering with our market, that there is a priority in terms of keeping those in check. But I'm not someone that has to answer as far as my budget to county supervisors or county commissioners and city council people. And so that's where you run into this conundrum about, will that part of the market be kept in check? Because there's a cause and effect between tax revenues and your ability to tamp those down.
Okay. And we can come back to these topics because I'm kind of going through a list here. But, Kevin, I wanted to ask you a bit. Now, you actually have a producer's license, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So you wanted to talk a bit about this pricing issue. We heard the sheriff describe the difference between the black market price and what the legal price is. So can you talk a minute maybe about supply and demand? And then is the price, too high currently in these legal shops? And do you anticipate it's actually going to go down to compete with the black market?
Sure. Like Ozzy was saying, and by the way, the coolest first name in law enforcement. the price is higher than the black market. And, just out of the gate, in an immature market, even if we're targeting only 25% of the market, it's going to take a while for prices to be lower. Ultimately, I don't see, especially if there's a movement at the national level, the black market being sustainable. When 80% of the revenues out of drug cartels are from marijuana, mm-hmm. if more states were to tax and regulate it and take that out of their financial stream, on the big picture, they're not going to have a chance. And I think that's the goal and that's the plan. In the short term, as a producer processor in the state, there's some conversations and contentions among producers and retailers on what the price should be. You mentioned supply and demand. If it was so simple, mm-hmm. there are maybe 200 legal stores where people can buy marijuana in the world between Colorado and Washington as of today. But marijuana is everywhere. And everybody sells it and can get it. So when you're talking about simple supply and demand, unless you're a consumer whose demand is explicitly targeted on legal recreational marijuana, and to be clear, there are people who have flown into Colorado and Washington, some on their own private jets, and they're disappointed when they go to a store, and because the price is only $25 or $30 a gram, they're sold out. They'd be willing to pay $50 or $100 a gram, but they would never go to the black market. On the other hand, there are some people who are only shopping for price. They don't care about quality. They don't care how old you are. Drug dealers don't ID. Mm-hmm. So it's not just simple supply and demand. However, as the fall harvests come in Washington on a micro level, you're going to see tons of marijuana on the shelves. And I don't see the price going much higher. And ultimately, as a producer, I think the price per ounce is going to be well below $100.
At some, how far down the road are you talking?
I would say maybe in the next year.
Oh, okay.
I really think that there'll be enough online and a big enough canopy and a large enough handle that by this time next year, the price should be more comparable with what they can buy it on the street for.
Kevin makes a good point. I think you look at the numbers right now, in terms of the number of retailers and producers that are reporting taxable sales, the ratio is about 1.1 or 1.2 producers for every retailer. That's not a good number. We need for retailers to have multiple suppliers. And as Kevin suggests, we know what happens in October when the outdoor crop comes in. That will depress the market. And as more people come online, we can talk a little bit about this later. But, the way this market was set up, and I do believe it was intended this way, is without a lot of restriction. We weren't looking at a couple mega growers. We were looking at having more smaller scale mom and pop grows, perhaps some people participating in the marketplace right now. And we knew those folks might underestimate the business investment and the expertise involved. But as part of that learning curve, that should come up and be up and running in the next 6 to 8 months.
Chris, can you detail a bit too, how did they make that decision to not have these mega growers? I mean, I know there was a lot of public input, but what was the decision making on
perhaps,
that?
Perhaps Allison can chime in here. I will say this, the way the initiative was written, there weren't real market barriers. You pay $250 for an application, you pay $1,000 for an annual license. In Colorado, it's much more expensive in order to hold a license. And so that was the issue, whereas you could hold a lottery in the case of retail. In the case of producers, what we heard clearly from the forums we did was, I intend to participate in this market. I can participate as a licensee, or I can participate outside your system. It made very little sense, even though from a regulatory standpoint, it would be nice to have 10 producers and you only had to enforce and regulate 10 people. That would not have been realistic. So it was what was handed to us. And quite frankly, I think it is what made the initiative, I think, much more appealing to people. The idea that you wouldn't have a few mega growers operating an oligopoly, but you would have the ability to start a number of businesses.
Okay. Now, this is a question that any of you can pick up, and Allison may know this too. But so you mentioned if the price is going to going down, what about the tax revenues? I mean, are they going to be made up by that, by the sheer volume of sales? Is that the idea here?
Or? I believe so.
Okay.
I believe so.
So even if the price goes down, there we'll probably still be picking up these tax revenues. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the driving issue. I know this is kind of a contentious one about the amount of marijuana that can be in your system. Maybe the sheriff and or Allison, you guys can talk about this a bit because I sort of know the details about the micrograms per liter or whatever, but can we talk a little bit about what is allowed? Maybe Allison, you helped craft the law. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Let me briefly, though, go back to what Chris was talking about in terms of what the market looks like and the sizes of the growers.
Yeah.
There were three different policy considerations that were animating the drafting of 502 when it came to the very low barriers to entry, the $250 fee application. First of all, is we wanted to bring as many people out of the cold into the 502 system, which Chris is referencing. He's talking about the fact that you've got all of these growers. I mean, the marijuana market in Washington State has been dominated by hundreds of domestic growers for many years, and we wanted to give all of those people an opportunity to become legal and legitimate, and so bringing in as many people as possible. Second is from an ACLU perspective, we wanted people who had been impacted most significantly by marijuana prohibition, people that had been disproportionately caught up in the criminal justice system as a result of their involvement in marijuana activity, to be able to participate in this new market. I think we've had some success with that. I think there have been some legitimate criticisms both of Colorado and Washington, that while there have been a lot of conversation about the fact that marijuana prohibition disproportionately impacts people of color, the marijuana marketplace still looks very white. But I think we tried as much as we could to keep the market open, mm-hmm. so that those who were selling marijuana before could come in and sell marijuana in the new system. Finally, talking about consolidation of the market in the hands of a few people, we're looking at this from a public health perspective. We didn't want a few big operators who would have big advertising budgets, who would be very motivated to advertise and promote marijuana use, especially to our young people, as we've seen with alcohol and tobacco. So keeping the operations smaller means they have smaller budgets, and hopefully less of an impact in sort of the more problematic promotion of marijuana use. On the impaired driving, the background on that policy-wise was that we looked at what had happened in California with Proposition 19 in 2010. A significant number of the people who said before the election that they were going to vote yes on Proposition 19 switched their votes to no because law enforcement there was very effective at getting the message across that this Proposition 19 has nothing that addresses impaired driving. We're going to be legalizing marijuana and not giving law enforcement any tools mm-hmm. to combat impaired driving. And when we asked Washington state voters, as we were drafting 502, how they felt about including something that looked similar to the 0.08 standard for alcohol impairment, they felt more comfortable with moving towards legalization if the initiative did include a standard like that. And we were looking at polling numbers in the low 50s when we were drafting 502, and we knew that we couldn't afford to lose any votes if we were going to get the voters of the state to pass marijuana legalization. So we wanted to include a standard that would address that concern.
And so how did that standard come about? I mean, how did you determine the, and what is it again?
It's 5 nanograms of active THC to be distinguished from the inactive metabolite that sticks around in your system a lot longer that people get in trouble with on job screens, for example. 5 nanograms of active THC in whole blood. Where that came from was the very limited body of scientific literature that was available at that point that suggested that at 5 nanograms, you started to see an increased correlation between the THC level and the risk of being involved in a motor vehicle accident. I will tell you that there are some studies that have been published since then that say 5 nanograms is too high. There are also studies that say that people who are heavier users, like medical marijuana patients, will not be impaired at that level. And it's pretty clear that we can't draw the same sort of clear correlation between active THC levels and alcohol when it comes to impairment. That being said, a per se standard is first and foremost intended simply to get people to say, look, if you think you're close to the limit, just don't get behind the wheel of a car. Just don't take the risk. But we will be watching very carefully, because what we would be concerned about is whether or not any unimpaired drivers were getting caught up in the system. From the ACLU perspective, what we see is that here in the state of Washington, we have a very strong state constitution. We have much stronger restrictions on when law enforcement can stop people on suspicion of driving. There has to be probable cause of impaired driving before you can be taken in to have a blood test in the first place. So we don't really see this per se standard as changing officer behavior in the field very much. But that being said, we will watch it closely.
And we can talk to the sheriff here in just a moment about how they're actively using that standard, or if they're what they're doing at roadside stops. But so I want to ask you a couple things. So this, when I had done a series of stories leading up to I-502 on the ballot, I interviewed several experts, as they called themselves, on marijuana. And well, one thing I asked several people was, what kind of advice would you be offering to people that are partaking? I mean, can you see, it's not like a drink where you know that there's, you know, X number of ounces of alcohol and you're going to reach that 0.08 limit. You're going to this marijuana store and buying some marijuana. It tells you the THC content. But is the average person supposed to know if maybe they're driving and they don't feel impaired that they may actually be over that limit? I mean, are we offering them any advice on this, or?
What we said during the campaign, and the sheriff may have new updated information, but during the campaign, what we said, if you're either smoking or vaporizing it and taking it through your lungs, wait 2 to 4 hours after your last use before driving. If you're eating it, so it's going through your digestive system, wait 4 to 6 hours. But I don't know if there's updated advice that law enforcement is offering.
And Sheriff, you can address it, because I've got a couple follow-ups for both of you, but go ahead.
I can give you... as far as the state patrol, we've never seen anybody at 5 nanograms. The highest level that I've heard of through the discussions on this topic is 3.8. And the trooper that told that number to us said that this individual was, quote, baked. I mean, just very, very impaired.
Mm-hmm.
So... our concern is, you've set a level at 5 as your per se, and we've never seen anybody at 5 yet.
And there's no roadside test, right? So at this point, this person that tested at that level had to go back for a blood test.
And there are roadside tests for impairment. And it's a standard impairment test. You have drug recognition trained officers that can evaluate different drugs as far as what the person may or may not be on, mm-hmm, while they're driving impaired. So it really comes down to the roadside being, are you impaired? Can you function? And at that point, when that gives us a probable cause, we arrest. And in order to figure out, you know, how impaired you are, we draw blood.
Now, Allison, do you, or either maybe Kevin even knows too, as far as this test goes, are you familiar with anybody that's tested higher than this level? Because I've got some information here I wanted to share with you, but I want to ask you guys first.
I'm not familiar with anyone that's tested higher than that level in the context of having been pulled over for suspected impaired driving.
Okay.
I would hope that with our current reform of the laws here in Washington, that we could do some substantiated research and validate impairment and the nanogram limit. Nobody should drive stoned. I mean, impaired specifically.
Yeah.
And there's one part, you know, it's so early for the state of Washington to really, you know, dive in and, well, here's what we're seeing. But in Colorado, they've seen a 100% increase in traffic fatalities in their marijuana range. And the majority of their DUIs have some kind of marijuana involvement. Now, I need to dive in and find out what that means. You know, does that mean they had it on their possession or had they taken it? But the study then goes on to state that about 25% of their DUIs are marijuana related. So those are some of the details that are starting to come out of Colorado. Those are the same type of details that we'll be pulling and looking at in the state of Washington to try to figure out what effect this is going to have. But, you know, we really do need to really relook at this per se level, because this per se level may be way higher than it should be set, and we're not protecting the citizens at that level.
Now, just quick question, follow-up. Now, does Colorado have the same kind of blood level standard, or what is theirs?
It's the same blood level standard, but theirs is a presumptive standard, so it is not per se. Per se meaning you can be found guilty of DUI simply on the basis of the 5 nanograms. Washington is per se. Colorado's is a presumption. And I just want to add something to what Sheriff Knevis is just saying here, is that, and this is something Chris Marr can also comment on in the context of allowing liquor licensees to be selling marijuana, is that one of the most important things that people in Washington and Colorado need to know is that marijuana and alcohol combined has a synergistic effect that is much more dangerous. And I don't know if the data that the sheriff is talking about is marijuana only, or is it polysubstance? Is it combined with alcohol? But that alcohol marijuana combination kind of makes the per se standard irrelevant, because we really don't know how bad the synergistic effect can be, and we don't have a good way of measuring that.
Okay. Now, this is the follow-up, and you've kind of addressed this already, Allison, but you're probably familiar with Dr. Gil Mobley, I believe. So he's a guy that I interviewed before the election, and this is the information that he had told me. He had done some he works in Washington State doing disability determinations as well as medical marijuana evaluations. But his concern about the 5 nanogram limit, he said he evaluated 8 of his patients and he paid for blood tests on them. So when you hear these numbers, you're going to be very surprised if you haven't heard this yet. Simply that he said he tested his patients in the morning before they had medicated, right? And he had a woman, so these are medical marijuana patients that are taking high dosages. He said he had this woman that tested at 140. And he said, quote, and I was going to get the soundbite, but his quote was, "I am telling you, she was perfectly fine to drive." And so I'm just asking for your reaction to that. This is apparently from a medical doctor.
I would have to look at his studies, because I can tell you that from the information we've been given from the State Patrol, and they do most of the DUI enforcement in the state, they've never seen a 5 driving.
Okay. Interesting. Allison, do you have some feedback on that? Because I know that you kind of debated that whole fact before the election, or before the 502 vote.
Well, the only two observations that I have, just looking at this from strictly from a data standpoint, is that the way that THC behaves is that it spikes very quickly after use and then drops very quickly as well. So when we're talking about law enforcement officers who are taking people in for blood tests, these are people that have not used for a significant amount of time. And so they may have been at 140 at some point, and now they're down below 5. And hopefully they were down below 5 before they got behind the wheel of the vehicle. The other thing I would say is that you cannot compare any sort of impairment test done in an office setting with a doctor who is talking to a patient about doing an impairment test, with reaction times on the road, when you have unexpected things happen, like a child run in front of your car.
Right.
People who are using marijuana do have impairment. It's different from alcohol impairment, but divided attention tasks and things like that. Things, you know, cars are dangerous in and of themselves. Being impaired by anything, whether it's alcohol, marijuana, lack of sleep, is a bad idea for yourself and for everybody else on the road.
Okay. And I think the point he was trying to make, too, that he was concerned that maybe medical marijuana patients that are taking such huge dosages would maybe be accustomed to driving under these conditions, and so that he didn't think that was an issue.
What I will say is that there is a study that was done of heavy users in a controlled setting. They were taken into a medical clinic where they were locked down and didn't have access to marijuana, and had their blood tested on a daily basis, and there was nobody that was testing above 5 nanograms after 24 hours. So it's just not possible that a medical marijuana patient is going to test at 140, probably even a few hours after their last use. If they're constantly using, maybe, but that level is going to plummet within a matter of hours.
I think it's important to circle back to the point Kevin was making, which is there is a lot we don't know about tolerance, synergistic effects, all those things, which really begs the need to bring, especially as we have discussion around medical and health benefits, to bring some objective third parties. And we have one of the premier medical research institutions in the state, the University of Washington, to bring them into this discussion so they can appropriately survey the empirical evidence out there and conduct some of their own studies, because right now we're kind of dealing with anecdotal or unverified evidence. So I think it's important to bring this back to something that's more data driven. We really have, I think, a responsibility. We're not just setting up a system, we're setting up a way to validate these public policy choices. And I think we made the best calls we could make going into legalization, but I think everybody understands there's nothing sacrosanct about those standards. They need to be adjusted based on better evidence that comes forward.
Yeah, do you think it will be up to, it will wind up in a court challenge, and that may be the way it's decided, or I guess we can't tell at
this
point? You know,
per se's for marijuana have already been challenged in courts in Nevada and Georgia and other places, and I don't think that that's going to be the way that ours is going to be adjusted. I think that the legislature, provided with good information like Chris is suggesting, is the best way that we can address whatever problems there are that flow from this particular standard.
Okay. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to KSFC Talks. It's a special forum on the budding business of marijuana. Our panelists include Allison Holcomb of the ACLU, Spokane County Sheriff Ozzy Knezovich, Liquor Control Board member Chris Marr, and Normal representative and marijuana producer Kevin Oliver, and thanks to our media partner, the Pacific Northwest Inlander. So let's talk a little bit about these moratoriums. There's been some court challenges that I think one has been decided, but there's some counties and municipalities in the state that are saying, we don't want marijuana sales to take place in certain parts of the county, and I think there was at least one decision on that. Can one of you talk a little bit about that and where we're at right now with that?
Well, maybe Allison can speak specific to the legalities. I will tell you that, from the standpoint of setting up a system and making sure there's adequate coverage, and we think we have a regulated system that works well across the state, it would be nice to have had every locality appropriately zone these types of businesses. I will also remind people that unincorporated Whitman County did not legalize alcohol until 1996. So sometimes it takes a while to get localities there. Having said that, I think we will have much better geographic dispersion, availability, and convenience than presently exists in Colorado. Understanding where you don't, where it is more difficult, the point Kevin made earlier is that people still access the market, except they will be accessing the illicit market. So I don't think the challenge is going to be as great. However, I do think we need to find a way to normalize the business enterprise. I think for revenue reasons and keeping the illicit market out. But yes, and there are some issues, but keep in mind, there's no such thing as one specific type of moratorium or one specific ban. Some cities are doing their due diligence, and I think we have to respect that. Others, however, clearly have no plan to allow these businesses to operate within their jurisdiction.
And there was some concern that if their bans were upheld, that they might use the argument that it's against federal law, and that may tip the whole balance, though, correct?
Right. So the way that the federal preemption challenge could play out would be that a city or county that has a ban is sued by an applicant who says that the ban is illegal, and that locality responds with two different arguments. The first being, no, there's nothing in the state law that prevents us from having a local ban. But second, even if there were, federal law trumps your state law, and that would mean that the entire system established by Initiative 502 would be void as a legal matter. Now, I want to clarify quickly that that's a very different question from whether or not the federal government can come into the state of Washington and enforce federal law against everybody that's acting in compliance with state law. That is the question that was already been decided by the United States Supreme Court in the Gonzalez v. Raich case out of California. There, what the patient, the medical marijuana patient, was arguing is that under the Commerce Clause and the 10th Amendment, the federal government is prevented from enforcing federal law against California residents in compliance with California state law. And the Supreme Court said, no, you've got two different laws that apply within the boundaries of California, and the federal government is free to use federal resources to enforce federal law. That is still the case here in the state of Washington. If the Drug Enforcement Administration, if the U.S. attorneys here in Washington wanted to arrest every single person with a joint in their hand, they would be legally entitled to do so. The question that's being presented by these cities and counties, though, with their bans that are arguing, there's only two that have made this argument so far, the city of Fife and now Pierce County has raised this defense in separate litigation, is that under federal law and under the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution, your state law is invalid, meaning your state law enforcement officers, your state prosecutors aren't able to enforce Initiative 502. The judge in the Fife litigation, which has gone to a trial court decision, at least on this issue of both state preemption of the local ban and federal preemption of the state law, he didn't have to address the federal preemption question because he ultimately decided that Fife's ban was legal. But he did make the point of saying that he did not think that the state law was preempted by federal law. His ruling on whether or not state law, Initiative 502, preempts the local ban has been appealed. The applicant in that case just this past week has filed a petition for direct review by the state Supreme Court. It's unclear whether the Supreme Court will accept that review or punt it back down to the Court of Appeals, but that question hasn't played itself all the way out quite yet.
Okay. And I believe, Chris, didn't you mention to me that earlier on during the election, Spokane County was one of the counties that did pass it by a majority, and of course the our county commissioners have decided they didn't intend to enact any type of ban here.
Right, but then you have Pierce County, which also passed it by rather significant plurality, and it's taken the other point of view.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about one problem that people are perceiving. They're worried about children, you know, folks under 18. I mean, now that it seems like marijuana seems to be everywhere. I mean, we've got the black market, we've got the medical marijuana market, and now the legal market. What's the concern about kids? I mean, can we all talk about that for a moment? Because I know that's probably in a lot of parents' minds, mm-hmm. if somebody wants to jump in.
We're already seeing some of the effects of exposure to children. We had a situation where a young child came to school, obviously impaired.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, grade school. So a teacher reported it, got CPS involved, which activated us, and we ended up taking all three children out of the home. The infant had very, very high THC levels in their system. So we're already starting to see that correlation. And in Colorado, again, Washington, we're not at the level of being able to crunch numbers. They're seeing as far as exposure of children from ages 0 to 5 have increased 268%. So, again, what does that mean? It's a number. I'm more interested in what the really hard facts are and what this means for the exposure to our kids. Anecdotally, we've seen the marijuana trend, the use and experimentation, slip from high school down to sixth grade. And when you talk to some of these kids, when you know, the school resource officer talks to them, why do you have marijuana at school or whatever? Well, you made it legal. Must be safe. So those are some of the things that we're seeing. And in Colorado, you're seeing a large increase in suspensions from school because of marijuana being prevalent in the schools. So those are the things I'm a little bit more concerned about is the exposure of the younger generation. Because let's face it, we passed a law that made it legal for people 21 and over. It's not legal for people under 21. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you know, all this talk about, you know, decriminalization or not making people criminals, well, that's fine for people over 21. You done that, but you didn't do that for people under 21.
So what's the answer? I mean, more education, or where should we go?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you know, people tend to talk about this as if it's a question of access. And I really don't think it is. If it were simply a question of access, we wouldn't have been able to cut alcohol use down by youth. We've cut it about 20% since the 1970s. With tobacco use here in the state of Washington, we've cut youth initiation of tobacco use in half over the past 10 years. Once we dedicated resources to changing norms about what's healthy, what's okay, why is it more harmful for people under a certain age whose brains are still developing to be using intoxicants? You know, for me, one of the greatest tragedies of the war on drugs and specifically sort of the hysteria around marijuana is that the pendulum was pushed so far to the reefer madness side that it has swung back way too hard to the other side, where you have parents who are actually thinking that it's okay to give their kids marijuana, that it's because it's safer than alcohol, which objectively is true. However, that doesn't mean it's safe, and it's certainly not safe for kids. And, you know, we've just polarized the debate over the past two decades to a really toxic degree where law enforcement, public health, teachers, parents can't sit down and have a rational conversation about why. I mean, simply, if you're an adult and your brain is fully developed, you probably won't have really negative health risks from marijuana use, but it is really dangerous for your kids, and let's show you why. And let's actually invest more research in pinpointing just how dangerous it is and why, and getting good information out there. But it ultimately boils down to social norms. Are we going to be able to talk about this as adults? Are we going to be able to have the same kind of impact on youth use as we've seen with tobacco and alcohol? Mm-hmm. And are we going to continue to commit to that? Because I guess that's one of the main things that I'm concerned about in the upcoming legislative session is that we've seen the legislature raid tobacco education dollars in the past. We need to hold firm on the dedication of tax revenues to strong prevention, education, and treatment for marijuana as we're moving forward with this legalization.
Okay. And I want to ask you about another thing that could actually be a dangerous situation. And we've had, Chris and I have had this discussion too. And it kind of traces back to the situation. Maybe you've got some folks who smoked marijuana back in college or something. They thought, I'm going to go down to the store and maybe I'll buy some. And then they get in there and they see some of these edibles and maybe get a lot more than they bargained for. And I mean, it sounds like a humorous situation, but it could actually be very dangerous. Chris talked about the article by Maureen Dowd that was in the New York Times. You may want to, can you just refresh our memory what that was about and what she ran into?
Well, in the now much storied article, Maureen Dowd apparently paid a visit to a recreational outlet in Colorado and did obtain some cookies, my understanding is, was given some advice according to the person sold them to her in terms of don't consume the whole thing. Of course, she disregarded that and then found herself in a highly hallucinogenic state and wrote about her incapacity as a result of this as kind of an alarm around this. Now,
yeah.
There are a couple of issues here. One is, at the end of the day, you can only protect the consumer by informing them. But the second issue was that Colorado, remember, rolled out their recreational system on top of a medical marijuana system. Once you put the rules in place, it's very hard to roll them back. Colorado did not have strong rules, in my view, around product labeling, homogenization, dosage indications, all those things around edibles. They have since, however, adopted our rules in the state of Washington. And I think people are a little wiser. For instance, in this state, the product, a cookie, for instance, is now scored. It is homogenized. So the THC active ingredient is spread throughout it. And there's, and you can only have, the dosage level is only so high. So we've kind of addressed those things, but I want to go back for a second. You know, like anything else out there with marijuana, these products in unregulated form are widely consumed and widely available outside of our system now. We have no ability to control that.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, like the medical system, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So that could be a concern, right? I mean, does there need to be more of a public campaign to inform people about what you're getting into rather than thinking that you're going to be smoking marijuana from the 1970s and eat one of these brownies and you're like tripping for 2 days?
Exactly. There has to be some heavy education because 1995, THC levels were roughly about 3.9. Now you're pushing levels of 12.3. This is not the marijuana, the THC of your college days.
Right.
Yeah, it's different, and I think people need to realize that, and I think they need to be educated on that.
I think that that's a product of prohibition as well. You saw the concentration of alcohol, the concentration of cocaine. You see it when the black market is in control of it and it's unregulated. Getting back to Maureen Dowd, she just endorsed a public education and awareness policy in Colorado where there's a likeness of her on the hotel bed with her face planted, and the caption is, "Don't let a candy bar ruin your vacation. Start low, start slow." And,
oh, wow.
You know, to be fair, as high as she might have gotten, there was not a toxic response. I'm sure
right.
We could all grab a fifth and see who could drink it first, and we'd all die.
Mm-hmm.
And out of Colorado as well, we have a national outreach office in Denver that just opened up, where our main office is in D.C., and so far, no children have been able to purchase marijuana from their recreational system. I'm sure they are getting edibles. I think there's emergency room visits and whatnot. And I'm anxious to go over some of these other stats that you put forth when I get debriefed tomorrow. But the reality is, as long as it gets back to what I said, 21 and over, drug dealers don't ID. And so, you know, the problem with marijuana, it's not that it was invented today, and it's been around and it will be around, but the problem really is unregulated access. No responsible adult wants their child to be high, or anyone else's child for that matter.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about this whole security issue, unless anybody wanted to jump in with final thoughts on that. I'm just thinking, now the producers, you're in a unique position, Kevin. I mean, I believe that you have to have a number of cameras and all this set up in your property. But can we talk a little bit about, I mean, is law enforcement going to be jumping in at all related to the security of these guys that are producing and may have, you know, marijuana on their premises or?
Absolutely not. We do not have the resources to do it. There's actually, if we were forced to, it'd be an unfunded mandate from the state. We mm-hmm. just don't have the capabilities. And that's really Chris's organization's responsibility to make sure that they're in compliance with the rules operating that business. So I can tell you unequivocally, I have no plans of enforcing any security or helping with any security. If I were to do that, I'd be benefiting one business over the vast majority of businesses mm-hmm. here in this community, because we all have security issues that would need to be dealt with. So, no.
Okay.
Well, the LCB enforcement officers are deputized, I believe, as well, and they carry firearms. And if we're out of compliance, then they would probably deal with us on that level. I would assume if we were broken into and someone vandalized the property, that then we could call, you know, the
yes.
sheriff.
That's a crime.
That's a crime. And so that is, when you say I'm in a unique position, that is one of the, you know, greatest things that I've seen about this, is now the legitimization, the legalization of this industry has made it so that the producer is protected from crime,
mm-hmm.
and the kids are protected from the producer or retailer selling them the marijuana. There's not so much quantity going out of the retail stores now that it's making its way into the grade schools. I'm quite sure there's medical marijuana grows up and down every street on this block. I'm just
when people talk about the security of the system, and I know they, they focus on the 24-hour cameras, the alarms, the cyclone fences, and so on. But really, the biggest deterrent we have is our traceability system. So with a producer like Kevin, we know exactly how many grams of product he produced 3 weeks ago, how much was harvested, who that was sold to. If there's a discrepancy, and our folks have already spotted discrepancies and have already cited some producers out there because they can't explain a discrepancy based on the amount of dried product that should be available. We actually, in real time, have a number of analysts and investigators that are looking at this data as it comes in. The software we use, Steve, was already developed around hydrocodone and highly restricted drugs. So this is a level of detail that we haven't seen before, and quite frankly, we were given millions of dollars to develop it. Now, as it relates to local law enforcement, we understand our role and the job of our enforcement officers in terms of policing our own licensees. And our understanding is it's like our liquor licensees. If we see a law being broken, if there's a minor that's been sold to, we would involve and inform local law enforcement. But it is not their job to make sure our system and there's not diversion within our system. Certainly, we're going to have communication with the state patrol and with local law enforcement. That happens anyways. But we believe that the traceability system we put in place that's highly sophisticated is adequate for us to figure out who's operating within the system and outside. And quite frankly, I also want to go back to this point about youth access. If we were to find one of our licensees selling to someone under the age of 21, you've got a $2,500 fine and someone is getting charged with a felony and we're going to notify local law enforcement. On the other hand, if I am one of my licensees were to sell a fifth of vodka to someone, they could underage, they might be able to get that negotiated down to a $300 fine. Now, you can ask yourself, is that fair? Is that just? We don't know. We just know that was the expectation of the voters, is that we highly restrict it and make it incredibly punitive. So I would say we have not had an infraction yet, and I think you would have to be incredibly irresponsible about your own business in order to engage in a sale to a minor ever. There's too much at risk. You're going to lose your business and all your investment.
What about, can we talk for just a moment, too, then, about the security concerns, and I guess Liquor Control Board's in charge of this, too, just regarding the retailers. Have they gotten this figured out about dealing in cash only? I know that was a concern by the retailers. Did they get banking?
Well, obviously, we would have liked something clearer in terms of direction where all banks are participating in the system. Here's what we know, and it's been borne out by our receipts. Presently, about 82% of the tax receipts coming into our system are through banking institutions. What does that mean? It means banks are, in fact, taking green money and profiting it from it and banking these businesses. We have a cash window at our office, and we still have 18% or so of folks that prefer to deal in cash or for some reason have no access to banking. We think as time goes on and banks are more comfortable with our system, and we've been very transparent in terms of showing them our traceability model, that number will go up. But basically, the concerns about wheelbarrows of cash and so on, ideally, you want a totally traceable system. And I'm sure law enforcement isn't too happy about even a few people having to operate on a cash system. That will change over time. So right now, you are seeing ATMs in lobbies, and you are seeing people operate in cash, particularly at the retail level. But I don't think the real horror stories that folks predicted have come to fruition.
Can we talk just for a second? We're getting close to, I've probably got three or four questions. We'll try to get at least one or two of these answered. But a bit about, this whole sort of gray area about the medical marijuana. We had assumed that the legislature was going to take care of this last session, and it hasn't been. So we still have a whole industry out there of medical marijuana dispensaries, and it hasn't been figured out what's going to happen with this. Maybe input from any of you on that?
Chris may have a different take on this. I think we would have passed medical marijuana legislation last session that would have addressed that issue, but for the fact that the issue about whether or not the marijuana excise taxes should be shared with local governments was combined with the medical marijuana legislation. Two-thirds of the Senate passed medical marijuana legislation last session, and it should have passed the House as well, but for that question about whether or not the state would share any revenue with the localities. I think if we separate those questions in the upcoming session, we will see the legislature pass some legislation that will clean up this disparity between the unregulated medical system and the regulated 502 system.
Is it going to just fold it into the 502 system, or how? What's envisioned here?
The legislation that would have passed last session would have all of the regulation occur within the 502 system, but would have created essentially a medical certification for those licensees that wanted to be able to hold themselves out as having expertise around the medical uses of cannabis and would have staff on hand that could provide that sort of advice, and also would have created a system whereby patients could apply to the state for a card that would give them tax benefits at the register so that they would not have to pay the same tax rates as non-medical purchasers.
Would they still be allowed to produce their, to grow their own? Is that still in there or no?
Yes.
And the liquor board is agnostic on the issue of whether or not our stores would be selling this product, although we feel we could, or if it should be a separate system. But there are two principles that we think need to be put in place. One is a tightly regulated system that protects the interests of legitimate patients. The second thing is a level playing field that does not disadvantage our licensees that have agreed and borne the cost of a highly regulated system and are at risk if for some reason we open the floodgates. Just as an example, in Seattle, there are 21 502 retail stores, but presently I heard close to 300 medical marijuana dispensaries operating, and that's not a workable system. You just can't regulate that type of system.
We've got a couple minutes here to ask, just what does the future hold? I mean, is this like a living document where we can change I-502 or modify? And I'm thinking in terms of a couple things. And you know, if these seem far out, just imagine we never imagined that marijuana was going to be legal to begin with. So, I mean, are we going to see a marijuana tourist industry? There was talk about that. But I saw an article that Leah Satelli had written in Al Jazeera America saying that that doesn't seem to be coming to fruition in Washington. Is that going to happen? Will there be private clubs where people will be able to smoke? Or what's the discussion at this point?
Well, I will tell you that the drafters and sponsors of Initiative 502 specifically intended it to be a living, breathing document that would be modified over time. That's why we included in it periodic cost-benefit analyses by the Washington State Institute for Public Policy, looking not only at public health issues, but also at job impacts, economic impacts, every sort of a holistic view of how moving towards a regulated marijuana market could impact the communities of Washington, and provide that data to legislators so that in the future they would be able to make adjustments. And to their credit, the legislature has already amended 502 twice. And even when it was required to have a two-thirds majority to do that, it has made amendments that helped with implementation, and we fully expect that to continue to be the case. And I think 502 has a great advantage in that, and it is a living, breathing document.
I think any type of tourism industry matures, because we have had little micro bursts of tourism, whether it was the celebration under the Space Needle that we off the record threw impromptu, our name wasn't on it, but you know, so people could just come and. And luckily they've got a great city attorney over there. Or the people who just a few weeks ago flown in and said, where's the legal marijuana at a booth that we were doing in Seattle? I think by the time tourism matures to the point where someone can come to a bed and breakfast like they can a winery, there's going to be maybe movement at the federal level, at least another half a dozen states that are legal. So it'll be more of a moot point, I think, as far as Washington per se.
Okay. I think I'm going to wrap this up and just play some theme music going out, but I'd like to thank all of the panelists who've come in today. Thanks so much, you guys. It's been a fascinating event.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the program KSFC Talks, the budding business of marijuana. Thanks to our panelists, Chris Marr from the Liquor Control Board, Spokane County Sheriff Ozzy Knezovich, ACLU attorney Allison Holcomb, and Normal representative and marijuana producer Kevin Oliver, and also to our media partner, The Inlander of Spokane. Thanks for listening.